This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We begin our show today with Leanne Caldwell. She's a name that is now synonymous with American politics, having worked for many years at NBC and now for the Washington Post. Leanne was raised in Las Vegas, a championship swimmer for North Carolina State University, and she has been reporting for a couple of decades now about American politics, and that, of course, is at the very highest levels of journalism in this country with the Washington Post. And Leanne is here to talk about what's going on. And, of course, yesterday, the President of the United States met with the Speaker of the House, and she has reported on that, and we will get her take on everything pertinent in the Beltway. And good morning to you, Leanne. It's nice to have you on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. It's great to be here.
Tell us about Biden and McCarthy. What happened when the Baptist from Bakersfield met yesterday with the Catholic from Delaware?
Yeah, well, it was a 90-minute meeting. It lasted longer than anyone expected, especially given their posture heading into the meeting, where President Biden has said that he is not going to negotiate on this issue known as the debt limit. And just to remind your listeners that the debt limit is essentially paying the nation's credit card bills. The country has a $31.4 trillion credit card limit that it has already reached. And so it's Congress's job to lift that. So it's just about not defaulting and being able to pay your bills. President Biden says he doesn't want to negotiate on that. Kevin McCarthy, the newly elected Speaker of the House, is getting a lot of pressure from members of his Republican Party to ensure that any sort of raising the debt ceiling comes along with some big spending cuts. They have said that government spending is the biggest problem in the country right now, and that is what Republicans are focused on. And so that is what that meeting was about. And Kevin McCarthy coming out of that meeting was actually in a great mood. It was almost giddy. he says that it went really well. I think he also just liked being able to sit in the Oval Office, sit down one-on-one with the president for 90 minutes. They haven't really done that before. And he says, Kevin McCarthy says that talks will continue and they're going to schedule another meeting at some point in the future.
As you know, the debt limit has been raised many times under many presidents, including Donald Trump. Why is it a searing issue now as opposed to the Trump years or the Bush years or the Obama years?
Well, there's a pattern in Washington where the amount of money that is spent, usually Republicans care about that more, and Republicans tend to turn the other way when there's a Republican in the White House, and they tend to care about it a lot when there's a Democrat in the White House. And that's the situation we're in now. As you mentioned, the debt limit has been lifted 90 times in the last, nearly century, and three times under President Trump. But it has been there's always negotiations, and it's always contentious, but there has been two times in the past where it's been the most contentious. That was in 1995 when Bill Clinton, a Democrat, was the president and Newt Gingrich, a Republican, was the Speaker of the House. 2011, the same scenario. You had a Republican Congress under Democratic President Barack Obama. And now, again, you have a similar scenario, a Democratic president and a new Republican House of Representatives. And these Republican members are insistent that spending has to be reduced. And so they're using the debt limit as leverage in order to do that. So there's a lot of politics. There's a lot of double standards, but the circumstances are ripe for a debt limit fight.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to get in on the show today. And we are beginning with one of the top reporters, and remember the name if you don't know it already, Leanne Caldwell will be with us for a few more generations, I believe. She is exceptional at what she does. She's become well-versed on all the intricacies of Capitol Hill, as you can hear. And a listener notes that the deficit went down $1.4 trillion in 1 year under President Biden. So the numbers are moving in the right direction as far as spending. And, of course, the deficit went up, up, and away during the Trump years. But yet the Democrats themselves don't tout that very much. Why not, Leanne?
Yeah, it's a great question. And President Biden is starting to focus on that, saying that that he has reduced the deficit by more than $1 trillion in his 2 years. And you also have to remember, we just came out of a pandemic where there was trillions of dollars, more than $5 trillion that was spent by the government because of the pandemic. They flushed a ton of money into the economy as the economy was, you know, really uncertain. There was a government forced shutdown of the economy. And so, yeah, that increased spending, government spending. But it also, on the other hand, kept a lot of people on their feet, on their financial feet during these very uncertain times. And so a lot of that spending was during the Trump years. And a lot of that spending were when Republicans were in control, too. So it's, you know, it is very much a double standard. Democrats don't look at spending as problematic as Republicans do. This is a decades-long ideology and difference between the party. And so, you know, Democrats say that they are on the right direction, moving in the right direction, and they plan to make a huge political point based on what things Republicans say they want to cut, which they haven't said anything yet. They're just talking in broad generalities.
Well, what happens if neither side gives? And in this case, it's the Republicans who are drawing the line. And Joe Biden didn't really give any ground yesterday. All he gave Kevin McCarthy was 90 minutes and heard him out, which is admirable in these times. But I don't know that that's going to resolve what's going on with the Republican members of the House and the Speaker, who got in on the skin of his teeth. What do you think will happen if there is this collision, and will it be as cataclysmic as some are forecasting?
Well, it hasn't happened before, so it's really hard for especially political reporters like me to wrap our heads around it. But people who are much smarter than me on these sorts of topics, economists, people who study this, people at the Treasury Department, they say that it will be cataclysmic. It'll be absolutely horrible, not just for the United States, but for the global economy, too. And something that's really important to remember is how if the country defaults, it can't pay its creditors, which a lot of it is China, who we would have who we pay, who loans us lots of money. It's different from a government shutdown. We have been through government shutdowns before, and the public doesn't really feel the impacts of it. They might here and there. They can't go to a national park, et cetera. But if there's a debt limit, if there's a default, that means the government immediately has to stop paying its bills. That means if you rely on Social Security, you will not get your Social Security check. If you rely on disability insurance, you will not get that, or Medicaid or Medicare. There will be no money for FAA controllers to watch over the skies, the airports and the airplanes. There is just a long list of things that will immediately come to a halt. And then if you don't pay your creditors, then you default, and then that shakes the entire global economy. That'll shake Wall Street, which means 401ks and pensions. And not just Wall Street, but global markets around the world, too. So people are warning that this could be really, really bad. And I will say that there is kind of an education campaign happening among the Republican Party. Republican leaderships are teaching Republican House members what a debt limit is, how it is different from a government shutdown, why it would matter, and running through that so that people can also understand the difference between a government shutdown and defaulting, because even members of Congress don't understand the difference.
It could be a big moment in American life, and certainly on Capitol Hill, where Leanne Caldwell presides as an ace reporter and has for a decade or more. Leanne, right now, though, there's as much, it seems, attention on George Santos, the fabulist from New York, as there is on this. And you have covered that as well. It is a story that has all the ingredients of providing interest to the American people. What do you think about the fascination with Mr. Santos?
Yeah, it really is. It's kind of like an old school pre-Donald Trump political story scandal. There is a member of Congress who has lied over and over and over again about his biography, about what he's done, his family, money. There could be fraud and campaign violation components to this. And so it's a multifaceted story personality as well. And we don't know what the truth is.
Okay, hold tight. We'll be back in 90 seconds and spend a few more minutes with Leanne Caldwell. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Leanne Caldwell of the Washington Post. She logged more than 7 years with NBC. She's also worked with CBS, with C-SPAN. She has been at the very highest levels of American journalism, and she worked for CNN. And we're talking about what's happening in Washington right now, the fascination with George Santos, the congressman from New York. And our delegation in Louisiana has been largely silent about this. And Leanne, I suspect Speaker McCarthy, who told Santos, that appears to be the case, that he no longer would have any committee assignments, would like to get rid of this guy, but he's an important vote for the speaker, isn't he?
He's absolutely an important vote, and Republicans know that if he does leave office, there would be a special election, and it's a very, very good chance that a Democrat would win that seat, giving Speaker McCarthy one less vote. Right now, he has a 4-seat margin in the House of Representatives. That's the only number he can lose. He actually has a member who is very injured, won't be back for a few weeks, so he actually only has a 3-seat margin, so it's very close. So there's a lot more than morality at stake here. Among Speaker McCarthy, it's politics and votes.
Let's take one call for Leanne. Robin Dow, let's go. You're saying go to David in Atlanta. Excuse me, David, you're on with Leanne Caldwell.
You know, President Trump's Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, said the tax cuts will pay for themselves. Reagan cut taxes and doubled or tripled the national debt. George W. Bush cut taxes and doubled the national debt. Trump cut taxes, the Republicans, that the national debt increased almost $8 trillion. And I've read, on top of cutting benefits, maybe for Social Security and other vital programs, the Republicans want more tax cuts. This is like somebody putting a gun to your head and telling you to drink hemlock. How do you want to choose to die?
All right, well, Leanne, trickle-down economics, it may stimulate the economy, but it doesn't do wonders for the debt and the deficit, does it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's actually he brings up a really good point, because one thing that is not on the table among Republicans when they want to say that they want to reduce the debt is tax increases to help pay for it. They want to balance the budget, but they've really narrowed down the possibilities of how to do that, especially when revenue is not on the table. They say that Social Security and Medicare is not on the table right now anyway. We'll see if that stands next year or later after the debt limit is resolved, if it is resolved. It's not easy. You can't balance the budget. I'm going to get technical here, but just focusing on non-defense discretionary spending, which only costs the government about $800 billion a year. That's only a quarter to 30%, about a quarter of the budget.
Well, before we go, you are a fascinating person, and I've reflected on your past. And at a young age still, you have worked at the Washington Post, where you currently are, at NBC, CNN, CBS, C-SPAN. Do each of those entities have different cultures, or is it about the same?
That's an excellent question. They're all, haven't thought about this in a while. They do all have their different cultures, and they're all, I will say, great places. They've all treated me really well. I've learned there's great journalists at all of them, and I've learned so much at each one. jumping from television to print. I started the radio, actually, then went to print, and then went to television, and then back to print. So it's been quite a journey, and I just love how you're able to learn from so many different types of people, different organizations. But the Post is the best in town in the country for politics, which is why I went there.
It's a great newspaper, and I mentioned that you are a graduate of North Carolina State University, Communications and Political Science, but you went there on a athletic scholarship, and many journalists, sad to say, are not the best athletes, but you were extremely competitive, and I think are still active. Does that competitive zeal work for you, and how did you segue from being a championship swimmer to a championship reporter?
Oh, I think that the competitiveness really helped me out. But even more than that, what swimming taught me, I was a distance swimmer, was, you know, I guess the determination and I'm forgetting the word right now, but just to keep going, the
resilience, you know, tenacity.
Yeah. Yes, that. You know, you can fail over and over again in practice and meet. You don't meet your goals, and you just have to get in the next day and do it again and keep going. So in journalism, it's like very competitive, and it can, you don't like to get beat on stories, and but swimming taught me to just keep going and always try to be better today than I was yesterday.
Do you like Washington?
I do. It's actually a great place to raise a family. There's lots of greenery, there's parks, there's museums, you know, it's great. I have two young kids, and my son's birthday is today. He turns 10. Well, so it's a big day in my household.
Well, congratulations. And I know you're married to a physicist too, so that had to be an interesting coupling when you met your husband.
Yes, he tried to woo me on his doctoral thesis, and I didn't understand a word of it.
What was his doctoral thesis about?
Oh, my gosh. You had to ask me.
Something really
some
smart.
Particle physics, yes.
Yeah, really smart, yeah. Well, congratulations on a great family, and to Leanne Caldwell, congratulations on what you're doing for journalism at great levels in our world, and we look forward to a return visit soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye. And with us now in the Beltway as well is Mark Ballard of The Advocate and the Picayune, the newspaper of record in Louisiana. And Mark Ballard, you just got like a Chamber of Commerce endorsement from Leanne Caldwell of The Washington Post about living in D.C. You were talking about the traffic last week. Do you have the same vibe, or is it a work in progress now that you have settled in?
I do enjoy it, but I don't have small children. Though my daughter did also marry a physicist, so I don't know what that means. You know, all the connections, but I have enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to. I have to say, because of all of the things that she just mentioned about the, you know, the parks and the museum,
yeah,
and all of the monuments and the history of the place, which has always fascinated me.
And I don't want to get maudlin, but I think it's actually a good thing. I'm sure when you see these places, your beautiful spouse, who we lost, it's been a few years now, Donna.
Two years.
I know. She would have loved it. She would have loved all the cultural outlets in Washington, D.C.
Well, my daughter went to university up here, for her undergraduate degree. And so we came a couple of times to visit. And yes, Donna had the same sort of feeling as I do. And that is kind of walking in awe. And I had to reveal, and you'll think less of me, but I was at the White House last week. And I have got to tell you that I was not, your intrepid reporter. I was more of a, oh my God, I'm in the White House.
It is an amazing place, no doubt about it. And that's why, as much as we sometimes criticize presidents, when you walk in that place and you see a U.S. president, whether you like them or not politically, it is a case in which you're in the big house with the leader of the free world, and it puts things in perspective. We're all somewhat insignificant, no doubt about it, but when you're in that territory, you're, as my mother used to say, in high cotton.
Yes, indeed. Well, and I live in George Washington's hometown in Alexandria. That's where my townhouse is located, and I'm just a few blocks away from where Robert E. Lee grew up, and that kind of stuff, sort of that history, makes an impact. At least it does for me.
Well, and Leanne Caldwell, who preceded, just said that when Kevin McCarthy finished his 90-minute meeting with Joe Biden yesterday, he seemed starstruck, and I think that's understandable. But then the beat goes on, and we'll talk with Mark Ballard about that beat when we return. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and Mark Ballard is with us from Washington, D.C., where the beat goes on, and right now we have a collision perhaps in the works on the debt ceiling and much more from the Republican majority in the U.S. House, led by Kevin McCarthy, who won by just a few votes, as we know, took 15 ballots, and Joe Biden, who won an election by a landslide in 2020 by more than 7 million votes over Donald John Trump. But Mark Ballard, President Biden right now, is fully aware that if he wants to get anything done, he's got to work with Kevin McCarthy. Those two met yesterday, and McCarthy, who is well-liked by our delegation, I know Garrett Graves loves him a lot, he came out, and the initial words from him were quite charitable about Biden, and then he got to another room, and they became less charitable. But do you think there's going to be a collision, or will cooler heads prevail?
I think in the end that there is, but I have a feeling that it's going to be in June when they make that decision. But you really can't allow the nation to default on its debts. It would send us spiraling into inflation, into recession, and it would do the same for the rest of the world. So I'm pretty sure they're going to come up with some sort of deal at the end of the day. But in the meantime, I think that they're also there's going to be a lot of grandstanding. There already has been.
Well, grandstanding in Washington. Imagine that. That's like gambling in Casablanca. Shocked. But in each side protects its own. But George Santos is getting he's really getting a hall pass from his fellow Republicans. And I don't know of anybody in our delegation that said much about Santos, but this guy, now we all fib, and maybe politicians fib a little more than most of us, but he's taken it to a new level, hasn't he?
Yes, but he's also under investigation now. And as far as our delegation goes, is that they are parroting the same words, almost the exact same words as the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, and that is that, that Santos was elected by the people who elected him, and therefore he deserves a place in Congress. So,
and it was in New York. Imagine if George Santos had come out of Louisiana. People would be talking about what hayseeds and idiots we are, and we don't know what we're doing. He's from New York. How in the world did that happen?
You're absolutely right. But I think that even the New Yorkers are saying, ooh, this was a big mistake. And they've been saying that and asking him to step down, but he has shown no interest in doing so. But the FBI did yesterday say that they are launching an investigation into some of the schemes that he was involved with. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Now, Garrett Neil Graves, who turned 51 a few days ago on the 31st day of January. He is he's playing Hamlet on the Bayou. He's not said whether he's running for governor, but he doesn't have a whole lot of time to make up his mind. He's got 8 months and 12 days to go and before the election. And obviously he would have to qualify and raise money and all that, and he would immediately be a viable candidate. But is he going to pull the trigger, or is it too late?
He has said repeatedly, even after given that big job on Capitol Hill by Kevin McCarthy, that he still hasn't made up his mind. You know, so he's sticking with the "I haven't made up my mind" and not otherwise answering the question. So at some point, the moderate money for moderate Republicans is going to have to land on somebody, and they're hoping it'll be Graves, but it may have to be somebody else. So
yeah, and Graves has Richard Lipsey as a big supporter, and he's a guy who has a lot of money and could help him, and is wanting him to run. And Graves himself has said that what the Republican Party did in immediately endorsing Jeff Landry was irresponsible, but he's got a chance to do something about that. It would seem that if he doesn't, it's basically the old all hat, no cattle act. I don't know that the other Republicans, Mark, and they're good people. And we're talking about Richard Nelson, who is with us, who I think is an exceptional young man. And if he had money, he would be dangerous. And then there's Sharon Hewitt, who's a female Republican, very conservative, but a female. She's in the race. And then there's John Schroeder, who is treasurer. You think he would have the mechanism to raise some money. But right now, I would think that they will have a very long shot in trying to stop Landry from getting the majority of the conservative vote. Graves would be a different story, though. So he wants to be governor, but yet something is not there to let him pull the trigger right now. Is it a case where he may wait? Or is it just that he doesn't want any part of Jeff Landry, who will run a savage campaign against him if Graves gets in the race?
I think it could be a little bit of both. I mean, he's playing Cincinnatus on this, but he's wanting to become governor by acclamation. But if he does get into the race against Jeff Landry, you can pretty much be assured that it's going to be a savage race, and mm-hmm. that everything that he has never wanted to come out will come out. And we will not have a George Santos problem in Louisiana.
No, and I imagine Landry's foibles will also be exposed. And that, of course, opens the gate for a Democrat to get in with one of the Republicans, and in this case, probably a wounded Republican. But the Democrats don't have their act together. The party chair is looking like she might run. Sean Wilson is he's playing dodgeball right now, but hasn't said no and would be a formidable right. candidate. And then Hiller Moore, I think he's like Garrett Graves. He would like to run, but he's no fool. Hiller's a good bean counter, and he's not going to run if there's another prominent Democrat in the race. He's waiting to see. So how do you see the Democratic lineup shaking out?
Well, yeah. Last week when we had Washington Mardi Gras, this was the prime topic of conversation in the hallways of the Washington Hilton headquarters of the Washington Mardi Gras. And the Democrats held a breakfast on Friday in which this was the only thing that they talked about, you know, who, and they were kind of handicapping who might be in or out, and no names really emerged out of all of that. Troy Carter, the congressman from New Orleans and North Baton Rouge, said that he thinks that there will be at least one Democrat, but they're trying to figure out who that's going to be, and they all seem to think that there's time to do it. So,
listener, this is Hal in Monroe. And by the way, if you'd like to get in, 877-217-5757 or talk@talklouisiana.org. Hal in Monroe notes that Jim Bernhardt sold a portion of his company yesterday for $1 billion. That's with a B. He's a Democrat, and he's got money and name recognition to some extent and a lot of money to buy the other name recognition. He would be a guy who is one of those people who could get in late and make a run of it. I don't know. He's a former party chair, by the way, of the Democratic Party. Any chance that we might see Mr. Bernhardt get in the hunt?
Well, now, I had not heard about that, but yes, I mean, there is a good chance of it because he flirted with this back, you know, during the Jindal years about running when, you know, the party couldn't find a good candidate to do so. And so there was, you know, that seems like that could be a very likely possibility.
Well, he now, and he's now somewhat unshackled because he's got $1 billion. He gets most of that. I remember once, and I don't think I'm betraying anything, but when he sold the Shaw Group, that's a publicly traded company, he said, you know, I only got $200 million out of that.
Oh, poor him.
Well, I think he's probably the second richest person in Louisiana now behind Gail Benson of the Saints and Pelicans and car dealerships and you know what. But Bernhardt's got some, as Gus Weill used to say, he's got some dough. He's got the dough, so he can make a run for it if he wanted to. And we shall see. But on the Republican side, I mentioned it before, every Republican running so far has some issues. The others have name recognition and money issues, and Landry, of course, is viewed by many as being a Vitter-esque guy who wouldn't be palatable with moderates. They may be right, they may be wrong, but that's the way he's viewed, and there's always the prospect until further notice. Now, Graves would change that, but if he doesn't run, what about former Governor Bobby Jindal, Mark Ballard?
Oh, that would be interesting. I'm pretty sure he won't run, but that would be interesting to see him getting back in. And, you know, he could easily do so, but I'm not sure that he polls very highly still after after his two terms.
He doesn't poll well. There's a little argument about that, but neither does Landry. And neither does any Democrat other than John Bel Edwards. Amazingly, I saw a poll the other day. The governor's reputation is largely intact. And if he were running again, Mark, I think he would win.
I think he would win, too. The thing to remember here in Louisiana politics, particularly with the open primaries that we have, is that if you have your particular base and you can mobilize them and get them to the polls, then there's a better and even chance of you getting into a runoff with, 20% of the vote, with 25% of the vote, even less in some cases. And I think that's what a lot of them are banking on. Jeff Landry could get 20% of the vote, find himself in a runoff and win because he has an R behind his name. And I think that's what a lot of those folks are counting on.
Okay, well, we'll pick up with that, and Landry is he's a good politician. We'll talk about it. 877-217-5757. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 for Mark Ballard, now covering the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., for the Advocate in the Picayune, and he still follows Louisiana politics. And right now, we have a case in which we're trying to discern who will be in the field for governor, and the election is 8 months and 12 days away, the October 14th primary. And Jeff Landry got a head start. He's raised a lot of money, and right now he is the Republican frontrunner, has his party's endorsement, and he also has some support from places you wouldn't expect. I hear Cleo Fields and Tony Clayton are in his camp, and I was driving through my old neighborhood in Mall City the other night off Florida Boulevard, and there is a sea of Jeff Landry signs through Mall City, an area where you wouldn't expect to see Jeff Landry signs, beautiful blue and gold signs, Mark Ballard. This guy is a good politician.
Yes, he's very good. He is very good, and he has been running primarily not as a conservative. Well, he does run as a conservative, but he's not doing arch conservatism, more of a we're going to open the tent to bring in everyone. And I think that a lot of professional politicians are looking at the field, looking at the money, because it's not just the money that he's raising, but he has associated PACs as well as the Louisiana Republican Party. And they're looking at that and say, he can't be beat. I need to, you know, make my peace with him now. And I think that's what you're seeing.
Ray in Prairieville. Ray, you're on with Mark. Good morning, sir.
Thanks for taking the call, Jim. My only question for Mr. Ballard, and I appreciate his comments on this show, is what does the Democratic Party have to do to get back to 50%, 49.8, 51? I'll take my answer on the air, by the way.
Thank you, Ray. Mark?
Well, I think they have to reach out to the rural areas, because it really is rural Louisiana, which can, they have more votes than the urban areas, that have felt the biggest economic crunch. They're seeing, they're feeling the lack of progress, and they have turned very red in that frustration that they have. The Democrats need to get out there and create programs, shift work so that you know your kid that graduates high school can find a job out there and does not have to go to the cities. This is something that they are aiming, they're trying to do. It's something that the Biden administration is making an effort at, but so far it hasn't made a huge impact on rural America, in rural Louisiana. Mm-hmm.
Scott in Central asked about what the Republican Party stands for today, and I think a good question would be, what do both parties stand for today? When I was a kid, Democrats were viewed as the Working People's Party, union members, and liberal on social issues, but social issues were not as prominent then. It was more bread and butter issues that dominated the political cycle. Now, Republicans were viewed as being charitable to business interests, trying to stimulate the economy, and more moderate on social issues. And in my day, that unfortunately meant the Barry Goldwater years. I was 6 years old when Goldwater carried Louisiana and Arkansas and Mississippi and Arizona and Alabama. Mark Ballard, it was a case in which the parties were more defined then. It's become more murky. What do you think each party really stands for?
Boy, that's, I'm hard put to come up with that, because they both say essentially the same things, except for when you get to on certain issues, and that's where they kind of diverge a little bit. The social issues that inflame so many segments of our society have been adapted primarily by the Republican Party, and they throw those they throw that red meat out to get people angry, about, I don't know, abortion or transgender sex, and then they move the rest of their agenda as well. The Democrats do the same thing, and except for they're pushing out for their base on issues that are mostly kind of pocketbook issues, but basically that that Trump was a fascist and trying his best to take away our liberties. So it's on both sides using these issues on the edges to kind of build their base.
Well, I suspect you're on these mailing lists that I'm on, and I must say I get emails from members of both sides of the aisle, but most of them are from Republicans and a lot from former President Trump. But here's one that was sent, just a few minutes ago from Kevin McCarthy, at least that's his name. And he writes, they're talking about the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi may no longer have the gavel, but do not underestimate her swampy scheme. She's livid that we took back Congress and is recruiting every last Hollywood elitist and liberal mega donor to flood my colleagues and I with dark money attacks. Now that Pelosi knows she has nothing to lose, she and her leftist followers are bolder than ever. They will do anything to stop us. That means we need all hands on deck right now to counteract her dark money tour so we can block Pelosi and Schumer's radical schemes once and for all. Please, would you consider, Jim, sparing a few bucks to ensure that we can hold off Pelosi's final charges against our freedoms? That's from Kevin McCarthy.
Well, like, as I say, trying to inflame in hopes of raising money and gathering support. And that's exactly what it is. I've seen John Kennedy send out he just got elected for 6 years, but he's still asking for more money to help him in the fight against Pelosi and
Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Democrats in general, you know, who are trying to turn us into a socialist nation.
And remember Pelosi, who I think is a brilliant political operative, one of the most brilliant in modern time, was, according to our junior U.S. senator, his assessment of her was, it must suck to be that dumb. Stuart downtown. Stuart, you're on with Mark. Stuart, good morning, sir.
Are you? Great. Jim, Mark, and the audience, good morning. Mark, you too, Jim. How do you think with the Baton Rouge's current police chief, Chief Paul, indicating that Blaine Salamone should have never been allowed to serve on anyone's police department, and yet Jeff Landry cleared Mr. Salamone as if he was some saint or something. How do you think this may impact?
That's an oldie but goldie. And by the way, Chief Paul will be with us tomorrow. But Stuart, it wasn't just Jeff Landry that didn't file charges against Salamone. It was the U.S. Justice Department as well. He got, and it's not cleared either. You know, prosecutors have a tough job. They have to decide whether they can get a conviction. But when Landry made his statement, Mark, it appeared that he thought Salamone did the right thing. I don't think he would back off from saying that.
Well, I think that they're two separate things. That Chief Paul is looking at the overall record of the officer, whereas the Department of Justice and Jeff Landry's Department of Justice were looking at a specific set of facts, and the facts had to fit a specific crime. And so, I mean, they're two related but two different things.
Carolyn Jefferson Terrace, Cheryl, please be concise. You're on with Mark.
Yes, you talk about the difference between Republicans and Democrats. We have gotten under Democratic control, finally funded the fund that backs pension plans, which is going to help a lot of people that voted red. And also they upped the funding for the National Labor Board.
All right. Well, Democrats tend to be in favor of those sorts of things, and Republicans often are as well. But you're right, Mark, and I think our previous guest, Leanne Caldwell, reflected on this as well, that if you're going to worry about the debt ceiling, then some ways, you know, you not only have to think about cutting, because you're going to end up cutting things that people hold near and dear, perhaps like Social Security and Medicare, but you're also going to have tax increases. And you know, 35 states swimming in this COVID money, 35 states have cut taxes this year. And that could be a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, oftentimes I think that accountants don't actually, aren't really involved in government spending, because it's mostly done for votes. And what the caller is correct, he did all of that. But the Republicans would counter that spending has created inflation, which costs us in a different way. And that is a difference between the two. I just think that I think that we spend what we get.
Now, tomorrow, Chief Paul is slated to be with us, and he is more than willing to talk about the tragedy in Memphis with Tyre Nichols being killed by police officers. And that is a story that has, for good reason, been a dominant one this week. Is it being talked about much in Washington, or is this just like, oh, this is another one? How's the elite in the Beltway responding to this, Mark?
Well, I would have to say that, you know, both the Washington Post and the New York Times led with what happened in Memphis, I think, two or three times in the past week or so. It is talked about quite a bit. The president, in addition to sending Kamala Harris, the vice president, also sent Mitch Landrieu and a couple of other members of his close staff to go to that to go to the funeral yesterday.
And we'll talk about it tomorrow with Chief Paul, and we'll visit with Mark next week. Thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure. Signature support for Talk Louisiana is from First Financial Tax and Accounting.